Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Synapse, Think Tank of the Air, featuring influencers, creatives, and thought leaders in the Twin Cities. And now, here is our host, Steve LeBall.
Hello, welcome to Synapse Think Tank of the Air. I'm your host, Steve LeBeau, and we have a special guest today, Abir Sen, who's the CEO and co-founder of Gravy. We're going to find out what Gravy it is. And well, that's right, with Thanksgiving coming up, gravy is a big topic anyway, right?
Yeah, hi, Steve.
Hi. But you have used that idea of gravy in some of your promotional talks, right?
Indeed, we have. You know, the idea when we started the company is we're looking for a not-so-boring word for benefits, because ultimately we're in health benefits.
Ah.
So the idea was that when you work, you get wages, and everything else is gravy.
Okay.
So how do we make those that gravy as good as it can be?
Okay, so we'll find out what the gravy is as we get there, as we get to that course. But you're a serial entrepreneur. And let me see if I have these correct. I'm not sure if it's the right order. Bloom Health?
Bloom Health, yep.
Did you name that too?
My co-founder did, actually.
Okay.
Again, you know, the idea was, could we bring something new to market in healthcare? Bloom, you know, with flowers.
Right.
Kind of a fresh start type thing.
Sure. To flourish.
To flourish, yeah.
And Definity Health.
Yes, that one I did not name, and neither did my co-founder. We had a marketing firm that did that.
Oh, okay, so that's a very expensive name.
That was an expensive name, amongst the three.
Well, Red Brick Health.
Red Brick Health, again, a wellness company, still in downtown Minneapolis.
Okay.
And also named by a marketing person.
Wow. Brick is the opposite. Now, what they say is usually digital versus, a brick building. Right?
Yeah, yeah. I think the idea with Red Brick was we were trying to create a path for employee wellness. So how do you get someone to get to where they need to be, you know, regardless of the hand they've been dealt, if they're 25-year-old and perfectly fit or 50-year-old and diabetic, ultimately was an employer wellness company. So the Red Brick path, if you will, to health was the idea. I believe it was a long time ago. It's about 13 years ago when we started it.
Right. Well, everybody's already done the yellow brick.
Yeah.
You don't want to do that one. So one brick at a time, that's kind of way of building.
Yeah, there you go.
So you have a lot of good images in your names anyway. Some of those companies were worth it to pay the marketing people, right?
It was.
So there are a lot of ways we can start. First of all, I worked for a company that actually had gravy as our benefit provider.
Right.
But is that the right word, benefit provider?
Yeah, benefit provider, you know, health insurance provider. You know, the average person, it's all the same. But ultimately, how do I pay for healthcare when I need it? Mm. And that's sort of what we're in the business of doing.
You know, I pride myself on being semi-intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a high school graduate. I have a BA. I have an MA. But when it gets to health insurance, I'm a total idiot. You know, I mean, they start going over these things, and I just say, you know, I don't. It's like, it's so confusing.
Yeah.
Now, where in your career or in your development did you decide to dive into that thicket of healthcare?
Yeah. So as often happens with these things, it was happenstance. So when I came out of college, I joined Deloitte Consulting, and we were doing a management consulting project. And my first project happened to be in the healthcare industry. So, you know, soon enough, before I know it, you know a little bit something, and then it becomes a little bit more interesting.
Well, maybe that's it. I don't know enough.
Yeah, well, and also, you know, at that particular time, and I was in my early 20s, I had a very unusual and complicated healthcare event. It happened to me at the same time.
What happened?
I had, you know, I just woke up one day, and you start having these fevers, and they diagnosed it as cancer. Turns out it wasn't cancer. It was this rare bacterial infection in my spine.
In your spine.
To gross out all your listeners.
Spine is very important to you.
Yeah, very important. And I would prefer it not be infected with bacteria if I can avoid it. So But what happened was that it was misdiagnosed for a while, not because of anybody's fault, but it gave me a front seat view of the intricacies of the healthcare system as a patient really going through it.
I imagine if it was rare, people haven't seen it, and therefore they don't know how to categorize it.
Absolutely. And I think there are papers that were written about me. Not exactly how I wanted to be famous early on.
So your 15 minutes is in a medical journal.
That's right. But what that did is, you know, juxtaposed with the idea that I was also working for a healthcare company at the time, just increased my curiosity about the field and, you know, how do we potentially make things a little bit better in any way we can.
Hmm. So you didn't study healthcare. What's your background educationally?
So undergrad was in economics.
Mm-hmm. Did you understand that?
Hopefully, as much as that's possible.
Well, that's another, you know, very deep and complicated field.
Yeah, and I did a concentration in philosophy as well.
So. Oh, okay. Well, I was a philosophy major.
Oh, were you?
Let's talk philosophy instead. It's a lot easier.
German philosophers. I can go there.
Okay, great. We'll do a little Heidegger here as we proceed. But then I read in your LinkedIn or somewhere that you also went to Harvard and got an MBA.
I did. So after the first company, Definity, was taking off, and I was, you know, there was about 8 co-founders of that. I was the youngest one. It was one time where, you know, if I wanted to get an MBA, that would be the window. So I decided to apply to a couple, and I got in one, and so I went for my MBA.
Well, I wouldn't say Harvard is one.
Well,
I got into this grad school. You might have heard of it, Harvard.
That was something that was appealing to me just because of the nature of the program. And, you know, it was a general management. So they don't really have concentrations. So you have more of a, you know, almost a liberal arts concept to an MBA education, which appealed to me.
My association of Harvard is that you have to study very hard. No?
No comment.
No comment.
I mean, you certainly can if you want.
Do you just skim through?
See, I think the way the MBA program works is a lot more about engagement in the class. Yeah, I mean, you have to study the case, otherwise you don't know what the conversation's about. But it is not, you know, study then provide an exam type education. So it was more, you know, you have 90 people, out of which a big chunk I probably would never have come into contact with in my regular day-to-day life. So very different backgrounds, talking about usually a business problem, but not always. And just coming at it from different angles. So that was the fascinating part, and seeing how people's perspectives and backgrounds, you know, the guy who was a Navy SEAL and his perspective is different than the guy who started a healthcare company. So,
well, because you had started a healthcare company, you had a perspective.
I did.
You weren't a blank slate walking into that room.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, probably a good thing when you're applying for something like an MBA to have some experience under your belt because it provides you with a little bit of context. You know, I'm happy that I got to work for about 4 or 5 years before I went for my MBA versus going directly after college, which I think would have provided a lot less value because, you know, I wouldn't really know what I didn't know.
I think that's probably a good idea for a lot of people that go to graduate school.
I believe so.
Get a little reality first before you hit the higher books. And I don't have an MBA. I know a lot of people that do. And I know that just in the general idea of them, for a while, it was like, you've got to have an MBA. And then for a while, it was like, everybody has it. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
Was your MBA meaningful for you? Did it build your mind out so that you felt more competent going back into your next entrepreneurship?
Yeah. I mean, I think for education in general, I think, but definitely for an MBA as well, I think the value has to be in and of itself. It should not be, in my view, a means to an end. So almost by definition in that case, the question is, did I find that it improved the way I think or provided, you know, additional richness? And it certainly did. Obviously, it's impossible to say whether my career trajectory would have been different without an MBA or with. But I think that lots of people are super successful without an MBA or even without a college degree. But there's some signaling value, I suppose, that going to a big institution that has a name and getting an MBA helps, but only helps for your first job. After school. And after that, it's, you know, what are you bringing and how are you performing?
What was your next project after Harvard?
So I came back to Definity, which had been sold in the 2 years that I was gone, to United Health Group. So I came back and I worked for about a year at Definity again, but now under United. And then a group of us, one of my co-founders from Definity and I left to start Redbrick.
Okay.
Along with a couple of other
people. Did you have equity in Definity?
I did.
Oh, good. So when they sold it, it was a good thing.
It was. There was lots of lessons learned in the first company.
Mm. What was your biggest lesson?
Well, I mean, there's some really technical lessons, like how do you negotiate a term sheet with a venture capitalist? And, you know, is valuation what you really shoot for? Or are there other things that could be just as important and valuation really isn't that important? So I think it was definitely from a lesson learned that there was a technical aspect of starting a startup, especially a venture-backed startup. That was an education itself. And some of it was, you know, what you shouldn't do.
Oh, how not?
You know, things as like one of the big lessons that I took away is I don't think startups should raise too much money when you start, because you want money to be a scarce commodity when you're starting an experiment, because really that's what a startup is. And having too much money sometimes gives you a little bit of a false sense of security, and you're probably doing some things which in retrospect you're like, well, I could have done it cheaper. I shouldn't have wasted money on this or that. So, and not necessarily pointing any finger at a specific Definity decision, but the headline, one of the lessons I took away was you don't want to have too little money, but there's also such a thing as having too much money when you go raise your first round as a venture-backed startup.
Well, that's probably hard for people to grasp. You could have too much money.
I think it is. And I also think that we have a culture in the startup world right now where raising money is almost an indicator of success, which it really isn't. Because if you think about it, you raise money because you're having losses. So the more money you raise means you have bigger losses, which is probably not a great thing in business. So raising money in and of itself is not something that people should be proud of. But you see, you know, the headlines, so-and-so company raised $500 million and everybody feels great about it. So I think that takes away from the true purpose of a startup, which is you have a specific problem for some specific customers that you're trying to solve. And how good are you at solving that vis-a-vis everybody else that's trying to solve that same problem?
So you've been solving problems in the healthcare sector. Is it a different problem with each company, or is it kind of the same?
It's a different flavor probably of the same problem. The gravy flavor. The problem, if I could state it, is underlying is that the financing of healthcare in America is unsustainable. And it has been for the last 10 to 15 years, where employers primarily have been financing people's healthcare, and it's great. People get good healthcare through their employers. But you have a situation where our healthcare costs are growing at 8, 10, 15%, depending on which part of the country you are. GDP of the country is growing at 3%, 4%. And those two curves are going to create a problem for every company in America. In fact, we see oftentimes where you have businesses where, 30, 40, 50% of their operating profits over a period of 3 to 5 years get sucked up just by the increase in their healthcare cost.
Plus, the individual employee usually has to chip in, and that's been more and more.
And the deductibles are going up, and and it's becoming more and more unusable even. So,
right, they had Bernie Sanders on TV last night talking about this.
Yeah, and the problem is, as a nation, we're getting older, and the healthcare costs are going up, some of it's because of waste, et cetera, but some of it's just because we're using more healthcare. So whichever way you slice the pie, does the employer bear it, does the government bear it, or the consumer bear it? And that really are the three options. So our sort of high-level effort is, could you align incentives in a way where you could solve the problem in a way that is good for all the stakeholders, not just employers at the expense of consumers, or consumers at the expense of the government, government at the expense of the employers, and so on and so forth.
So looking for some sort of fairness, but also sustainability.
Correct.
Now, what would be the problem with trying to get costs down everywhere? It seems like if you press down here, the costs come up somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, one way you could think about it is the cost of healthcare has two components. One is the unit cost, so the unit price of the services we're getting. And the second is the total volume of services that we're getting, right? And you multiply the two and you get the total cost. And the issue is that both are actually rising in our country. So the volume is rising, partly because, we are getting sicker as a country and older.
I know I am.
And the unit cost is also rising, partly because, there's new technologies, potentially partly because of wastage. So if you take those two sort of apart, I think there are different strategies that you could use to reduce both. So for instance, on the volume side, you know, if you can get people, give incentives to get them healthier or
preventive care,
you know, all sorts of, you know, direct primary care, give people encouragement to use the care that they already have access to, that could potentially address the volume. And on the unit cost side, you could have, you know, that's where the generic drugs versus name brands, if possible, you know, some of the companies are doing where, you know, you could have the same surgery, but in one, you know, one hospital, it costs X, and in another hospital, it could be three times X. So, and by the way, the quality is about the same. So, you know, kind of making those more, you hear price transparency a lot, and that's
so
really
so there can
about,
be more consumer choice.
And the consumer can choose the one that's most efficient, so to speak. So I think there are different ways you can come at the problem. But the underlying issue is still that people we are going to get older, at least for a period of time, and use more volume.
You get older for a while.
You get older for a while as a country before the age starts coming down. But so how do you manage that increase in costs that are going to happen?
Hmm. So this is a very complicated problem.
It is.
Do you enjoy that part of it, or do you enjoy starting businesses, or do you enjoy managing a company? You're a CEO. What part? Makes you healthier.
Yeah, well, I just saw a picture 4 years ago when we started Gravy, and my hair and my head was all black. And guys who are listening can't see, but it's all gray now. So
yeah, a little salt and pepper up there.
So, yeah, I mean, I think for once you're in the industry, it is definitely intellectually challenging. It is also gratifying when at the other end, after all the efforts, somebody's life is slightly better as a result of that. And we get some of the feedback. You know, we had a customer to call us from Indiana, and there was a young lady that was going through some health issues. And this customer was a CFO of this tech company. And he told us how her father had called him to give us compliments, her healthcare provider. Mm. So that obviously, those little instances every now and then are the much needed boost, if you will, to keep going on something that some days feels like you're hitting your head against a brick wall. So
A red brick wall. So you don't necessarily judge your success or your quality based on your spreadsheet. Sometimes you hear from humans.
Well, I think ultimately that is the only measure of success. Now, the spreadsheet is important because we're taking other people's money and we want to give them a return and all of that. But I think it's really important to know what is the driver and what is the result. And the driver, especially in some place like healthcare, has to be the humans at the other end of it. Mm. And if you do a good job for them over time, hopefully the spreadsheet will follow.
Right. Some of my best friends are humans. Is this your longest tenure at a startup with Gravy?
Almost. You're about the same as I was at Definity, but maybe Gravy is just a little bit longer.
Okay, so like 6 years or so?
6 years, yeah.
Okay. So now it's like if you know somebody that always moves to a different city, for you, you're always doing these – are you in the back of your mind, do you have like a back burner with a couple different startups starting to simmer?
No, not at all, actually. And it's just things just happen a certain way where, you know, if a venture-backed startup, there's an acquirer that comes in and puts in a good enough offer on the table, you're likely that your venture investors would take it, and that has happened a couple of times. One time I actually left Red Brick to go start Bloom because we saw the opportunity in the market with the changes that were happening. So it is very, you know, opportunistic, I would say, versus there's really no grand plan.
Okay. Well, you're flexible. That's part of the advantage of being an entrepreneur, right, is that you're not part of a rigid corporate structure.
Yeah, and in my experience, you know, just like the Soviet Union found out, 5-year plans don't work. You got to just react to what's happening on the ground and make the best decision with the information available at the time.
My adage is rules are made to be bent.
Yeah.
We're talking with Abir Sen, the CEO and co-founder of Gravy, a health care benefits provider company. That's perfect.
It's a mouthful,
okay.
But perfect.
I'm gonna stop there. You're listening to Synapse Think Tank of the Air. I'm Steve LeBeau. We'll be back right after this.
Synapse Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
Then we're back with Synapse Think Tank of the Air with our special guest, Abir Sen, a serial entrepreneur in the healthcare industry. He's currently the CEO of Gravy, a healthcare benefits provider to different companies. In fact, I was one of your customers once back at Tiger Oak. And I remember part of the deal is you emphasized customer service. There were all these people we could call and ask questions.
Right. So the basic idea behind Gravy is that, came from a problem that we saw in the industry, which is that the employer in our country is often the decision maker of their employees' healthcare because they pay for it. So you get this weird situation where your HR or benefits manager has more say over which doctor you can go to or what drugs you can take than you.
Because what do we know?
And also that leads to all sorts of downstream issues. So if you think about it, the way the supply chain works, the insurance company, thinks of their broker really as the customer. The broker thinks of the employer as a customer, and the consumer, the end user, is just a captive audience that the employer has brought to the table. And if you ask a layperson, well, who's the customer in healthcare? They'd say, well, it's the patient. But that's really not how it works in the way the industry is structured.
That explains a lot of things.
Yeah, it explains even people's incentives. So, insurance companies are busy keeping brokers happy. Brokers are busy keeping employers happy. Nobody's really that worried about keeping the consumer happy.
I just had pneumonia recently. And, the first antibiotic, I had a reaction to it. And so I had the anaphylactic response everything swells up and I couldn't talk or breathe. And so then I had to run to the emergency room.
Yeah, that's great.
And so then I had to get a different antibiotic, and I go to the pharmacy, and they say, well, your insurance doesn't cover this one.
Yeah.
So then I couldn't have my antibiotic. I had to go, and try to get another one.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the kind of problem that that we are looking to hopefully at least begin to solve. And our first step in that
process, should have called you.
Yeah, or even better, you should have had a plan where the insurance company is trying to say, well, how can we make Steve happy and get him what he needs?
Right. What about Steve?
Yeah, what about Steve? So, our model is we're really giving the power of the purse back to the consumer, where the employer says, look, there's $5,000, $8,000, $10,000 that I spend on healthcare, which is decent money. Today, I, the employer, under the traditional model, decide how that's going to get spent. I, design the benefits with my broker's help, and then I bring it to the consumer. Well, in the Gravy model, the employer just gives the money to the consumer, to their employee through our platform. And then you can think of Gravy as a marketplace of different products and services. So we assess every individual employee's needs and then create almost a portfolio of services that is exactly right, at least we would hope it's exactly right, for the needs of that person and their family. So you could have somebody, and a customer with 100 employees, and all 100 could have a different health benefit because they've chosen a different portfolio. So we're taking a financial plan approach to healthcare. So your financial plan could be stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and based on your needs, your financial planner puts it together for you, that portfolio. Similarly, we're taking that approach to healthcare, and so we're really thinking of this as the health plan of tomorrow, not so much as in a healthcare insurance sense, but in a financial plan sense. Well, what's the portfolio of healthcare services, including insurance, that could be exactly right for Steve? So the next time you need a different antibiotic, you could get it without having to run from pharmacy to pharmacy.
It's too late now, but now, so I can see how it serves the employee, the actual consumer, but the decision maker whether to hire you is the business
Employers.
Owner.
So for the employer, they now have to make one decision, and that one decision is how much money can I spend, do I want to spend on healthcare? Today, the decision is, well, how much deductible do I want? How much, what formulary do I want? Do I want this network? Do I want that network? And what the employer is trying to do is with that one decision, they're trying to meet the needs of every single employee, which inherently is inefficient because you really can't. So what you end up doing is you buy at the highest common denominator so everybody's needs are covered, which means that not only the employer, but the employee is also paying for a bunch of stuff that they may not need. So, for instance, you may have an employee that has an access to going to a hospital in Kansas, but they may not need a hospital in Kansas because they don't live in Kansas. They live in Minnesota, and they want a liner. So so we are able to sort of tailor, within boundaries, tailor the coverage and the products to the employee's needs. So two things happen. One is the employer goes on what I call a defined contribution approach. So just like they went from pensions to retirement and 401ks rather, and just said, look, we're going to spend this much in 401k. And then it's between the employee and Fidelity. Similarly, the employer says, I'm going to spend X dollars on healthcare this year, and now I'm going to give it to the employee, and now it's between them and gravy. So the employer, in a very real sense, now controls the slope of their cost curve. So from year to year, if their cost, they can say, I'm going to spend the same amount as I spent last year. I'm going to spend 10% more because that was medical inflation was. I could spend 20% more because my profits went up by 20%, but they get to choose. Now, that really, if you think about it, is a compensation discussion, right? So they are trying to figure out what should the contribution be so they can meet their objectives, which is to attract and retain the best talent.
So is this part of your sales pitch when you go out to try to spread gravy?
It is. It is. I mean, it's not a particularly easy sales pitch, as you can appreciate, because it's complicated, to your earlier point. But yeah, the sales pitch is two. One, employer, you're going to be able to pick how much you want to spend in healthcare. And you're going to do that while your employees are happy with what they're getting, because now they can tailor the plan to whatever they want it to be based on the money you've given them. So both of those sort of work together. Because if the employer just went to a defined contribution approach and the employees were super unhappy, well, that wouldn't work, because ultimately the employer is doing this to make the employees happy. If the employee is very happy, but the employer can't sustain the cost increases, that's not going to work because the employer can't afford it anymore. So this is a way where the employer can choose how much they want to spend and really keep control on that cost curve.
So your ideal company is one in which the employer is not a total dictator authoritarian, but wants to let the employees be the decision makers. And your worst company would be one where the employees don't want to make decisions. There are people like that.
There are. Well, let me break that down. I totally agree with the first part, is that we like where the employer acknowledges that they are in the business of making and selling widgets or whatever they do. Mm-hmm. They're not in the business of deciding their employees' healthcare.
Right.
If that understanding or that mindset isn't there, it's probably not a great customer for us. But then from an employee standpoint, you have the entire gamut. There'll be some people that just call us and say, hey, Gravy, and we have a service called Gravy Care that are licensed advisors that do this for a living. And they're salaried, they don't make commission. So their incentive is really to make the consumer happy. So you could have someone call in and say, I don't understand all this nonsense. Here's who I am. Here's my needs.
I think
tell
that's
me
what I said
should.
When I called in.
Tell me what I should do. So we have people like that and we can help them. And all the way to where people will go on the website and they'll slice and dice and use all the tools that are available to them and do it themselves.
So you have a guide for those that don't like to make decisions or get
frozen.
Buried or frozen is a good word.
Yeah, totally. So, and you have to. So the way that I think about our business is we're in the business of providing advice. We're not a tech company. We're not an insurance company. We're not a services company. We're all of that, and yet we're none of that. We're in the business of providing advice, and that advice just happens to be aimed at this problem of healthcare. And we have to be able to provide that advice in whichever way the consumer wants to take it. If they want to take it on the internet, on themselves, great. If they want to talk to a human being, well, then the people that they're talking to have the technology behind them to be able to help the consumer. So that's the way we think about our business.
Hmm. So how's it going? Are you adding more every year? I presume you have to, because part of the definition of success in a business is growth.
Yeah, we are. And we are growing quite rapidly. But I would also say part of the definition of success has to be profitable growth. Where especially as we, you know, in our marketplace now, we have our own insurance products as well. So we started an insurance company a couple of years ago.
Really?
Based in Vermont.
What's it called?
It's a very interesting name. It's called Risk Solutions Insurance Company.
Risk Solutions.
Very imaginative.
Right. Did they hire somebody to come up with
it? I certainly hope not.
Okay.
We want to grow, and we are growing, in some parts of our business over 100% year over year. But we also, you know, want to be smart about how we grow. Because in an insurance business, you can grow very fast and just end up losing a lot of money because you've underpriced your product. So,
are you across the country now?
We are. We have membership in 38 states now, including Minnesota, of course. And there are some parts of the country where we're growing faster than others.
Mm. What's the state you'd like to be in but you're not in yet?
Probably New York. We'd like the, obviously it's a big state.
The Big Apple.
Big Apple. I know that there's a healthcare is a pain point, but the regulatory is a huge regulatory regime. So we're still balancing the, you know, the pain of entering New York versus the gain.
So so you have to handle state regulations wherever you go?
Correct. There's licensing requirements and a whole bunch of other, which my co-founder is much better versed with than I am. It makes people very nervous when I start talking about regulations.
Is he a lawyer type?
He isn't, but his wife is a Stanford lawyer, so
okay.
he thinks he is.
But
we do have just
like all marriages, she's the brains.
But we have a good legal team that we worked actually since the Definity days, so for 20 plus years that have helped us in the benefits law space.
Do you have to do lobbying?
You know, we often get called in, I don't necessarily call it lobbying, but we do provide our input on a lot of different...
Arm-wrenching?
Knee-breaking?
So
unfortunately, as a small startup, relatively, we don't quite have the wrist strength to wrench arms yet.
Oh, okay.
But we had, you know, just a couple of recent regulatory developments. You know, we've had quite a bit of impact on, at least we think so. And I'm happy to go into details if that'd be interest to you and your listeners. But we're very involved in the way that the healthcare regulations get written and changed and modified.
Well, I know on the federal level, they're going back and forth. I mean, how many times has the president or the Republican say, hey, we're going to do away with Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and do something new? Do you worry when you hear all these things that everything's going to change all of a sudden?
I really don't. And the reason is, while it's, I suppose, good politics and definitely gets headlines when we talk about these big statements, when you really look down into what is happening on the ground, the regulations that we need, there's quite a bit of, you know, consensus amongst both the parties. So I'll give you an example. So when we first started Gravy, the money that the employer gave to their employees to go buy products with had to be taxable. It was post-tax. So we made the case along with others back in Washington to say, look, it doesn't make sense. If the employer buys insurance, it's pre-tax. But if the employer gives you money to buy insurance and all you do is just buy insurance, how can that be post-tax? How can that be fair? And people in Washington said, yeah, that makes sense. That argument makes sense. So in 2016, December, there was this 21st Century Cures Act where for the first time for small employers, Congress said, well, sure. Now, if your employer gives money to their employees to buy insurance, that's pre-tax. Initially, they said it's under 50 employees only. And then again, starting January 2020, for the first time, it'll be pre-tax for all employers, regardless of size. So now that was the ICHRA as the technical term for the account. But that's a good example of, I think the 21st Century Cures Act was almost unanimous. So there was not a whole lot of opposition there. The ICHRA law, which is more of a regulation, I think nobody's standing up and saying that's terrible and ought to be reversed. So from a practical standpoint, we find, people to be a lot more, you know, on common ground than it may otherwise seem. Now, that being said, there could be big changes. I mean, you know, you hear about Medicare for All and hear about, you know, many different proposals are out there. And our stance is, sure, we'll keep an eye on it. And as is required, we'll adjust our business model. But the fundamental problem that we're trying to solve for the employer and the employee doesn't go away. The employer wants to attract and retain talent better than the next guy. And the employee wants to say, look, I want to stay healthy, but if something bad happens, I want someone to help pay for it. And help navigate me through this process. That reality is not changing under any of those different proposals, and that's really what our business is about. The how we deliver on that problem may be different and may need to change, but if we deliver, it's probably not.
You mentioned Medicare for All, and I know there's a variety of proposals that fit, you know, that rubric, but I think the one that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are talking about would do away with insurance companies. I think I'm correct. How would you survive if there were no insurance companies?
There's so many hypotheticals in there that it's really hard to respond to that question. But let's take a real system out there, like in Canada or the NHS in the UK, where you have the government that's the primary provider. What ends up happening is, and I'm not necessarily saying that's going to happen here or that we would do it, but if, and there's a big if that ever happens in America, what would end up happening is employers will still want to attract and retain a talent beyond their competitor. So they're going to say, well, what package of benefits can I put together that sits atop this thing that everyone has access to that makes me a better employer? And that's happening in Canada, which has a national healthcare system.
So there are other products that you could work with.
And maybe it's, you know, there's insurance that sits on top and covers the stuff that the national insurance doesn't cover. So there are many of these different, you know, packages, so which is what I mean by when I say that the employer's problem is really not going away, of creating a compensation package, benefits being a big part of it, being the gravy of it, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But again, very hypothetical, and there are many things that would have to happen along the way. But that's sort of how we think about that movement to single payer. Regarding the specific proposal for Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, I wouldn't presume to know that I've read all the pages and know exactly what we would do. But
it changes every day.
Probably does. And
but the thing is that it's, you know, it's not imminent for one thing, but it's just that you feel confident that you have the kind of the flexibility to handle whatever comes along.
Absolutely.
Gosh. Of course, you'd have to maybe go get another Harvard degree to figure it out.
I think we just hire some at this point. Probably not from Harvard.
So now, do you use gravy?
Yeah, we do. In fact, my open enrollment ends tomorrow. So today, as I was coming over here, I made a mental note to go change my health insurance when I get back to the office.
Do you have to call up your people and say, explain this to me?
Well, sometimes, yes. But hopefully not this year, because I think I'm just going to keep very similar to what I have last year.
Okay, got it down. It's like my cell phone. You finally learn it, and then it automatically rechanges its operating program.
Yeah.
It's like, I got to learn it all over again.
I, you know, often explain it to my family as, you know, I'm terrible with, like, electrician-type stuff. I mean, there's stuff that I know I can do, but I'm still a little bit scared that I'm going to burn the house down if I do it.
Right, and plus you can die.
Yeah, you can die. So, and I think that's similar in healthcare, where it's some very simple thing. I think people be like, yeah, I think I can do that. But there's always this thought at the back of your head, am I doing something really, really dumb?
Do I want to put my finger in there? No.
Right, so... So having someone, an electrician or a gravy care advisor that just is by your side and says, nope, you did that right, is very helpful.
We're talking with Abir Sen, the CEO of Gravy, and we're finding out all about it here. In fact, I'm feeling healthier already just being around this aura here. I'm Steve LeBeau. We'll be right back with the Synapse Think Tank of the Air right after this.
Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back. I'm Steve LeBeau with Abir Sen. Abir, what part of Minnesota are you from?
Minneapolis. I grew up in Bombay, India, and I came to Wisconsin for my undergrad. Appleton, Wisconsin. And then Minneapolis.
Well, now Bombay, it's such a cool name, but they changed it to Mumbai.
Mumbai, yeah.
Well, is there any relationship between those two words?
Not really. So there was a big push some time back to change all the British-based names in India.
The British, they do that everywhere. They go and change all the names.
Except that in many parts of India, those cities didn't exist before the British. So in some cases, it made sense to change it back. In other cases, it simply made up a name where there was no name before. So,
wow. Do you have any sense of being in a post-colonial mentality?
You know, when you... So if you go to India, the colonialism for sure has its mark. I mean, the way that, you know, you still go to these old clubs in India, for instance, that were built in the 18th century and 19th century.
You got to have your little pinky out when you drink there?
But there are people playing polo out in front.
Really? Okay.
So there is definitely that. But otherwise, I mean, India's changed so rapidly. So probably that's getting less and less, you know, obvious to an outside observer.
Well, when I was a kid, they'd say, finish your plate. There are kids starving in India.
Yeah.
They don't say that anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is still a lot of, there's a huge dichotomy of and the wealth distribution. You know, if we think it's bad here, it's pretty bad in India. Hopefully it's getting better because the poor are getting richer. But are getting richer much faster.
Gosh. Well, just kind of like the U.S.
Yeah.
Well, in India, too, it's like the second most populous country, right?
Yeah.
I don't know how many hundreds of millions.
It's 1.2 billion almost, and it's 1.2 billion. And it's a 1.2 billion democracy. So that makes for a very interesting, you know, so it's the largest democracy by far in the world.
Wow. Did you grow up speaking multiple languages?
I did. So my mother tongue, I guess, as we call it in India, is Bengali, because ethnically my parents are from the eastern part of India. And I spoke Hindi, which is the national sort of, you know, ethnic language that everybody speaks. And then English, because that's the medium of instruction and the medium of business.
Mm.
And also Marathi, because that happened to be the ethnic language of the state that Bombay is in. So, I think it's very common for Indians to speak many languages.
Four language. Well, I have a daughter who's actually trilingual. And so we studied up on that. My wife is Japanese, and my daughter grew up speaking two languages.
Okay.
And what they say is your brain forms differently when you have these multiple languages going on. So do you feel that? Do you look at these monolingual people and say, man, you know?
Well, it's hard for me to tell because I don't know how my brain would be if I had only spoken one language.
Right.
But I mean, I don't think it's because, you know, I think kids are just adaptable. So it just seems like the same language to me. It's almost like it's the same language and you're just using different words depending on the person you're speaking to. But it's sort of weird.
Right.
So it doesn't seem like you're making a full-on switch to say, I'm switching from language A to language B. And I think that's because we've grown up with these languages when we are young. And sort of since you were born and starting to speak, you're learning all these languages at once.
Right. The mind is all flexible.
Right. It's a little different than I think when you learn a new language. So if I had to learn French, which I'm trying to now, it's way different and much harder.
Mm. Right. Well, that's because your brain got old.
Yeah, exactly.
What happened? Do you get a chance to speak those other languages very often?
I do, because I go back. My mom is still back in India. So I go back at least 3 times a year. So when I go back to India, I speak with my mom. I'm speaking Bengali. And, if I'm out, I'm probably speaking Hindi or English. So my wife, who's from Plainfield, Wisconsin, always...
Your wife's from Wisconsin?
Funny. She's from Wisconsin.
Holy cow.
So
she speaks English?
She speaks English and a little bit of Bengali.
Is she Scandinavian?
She's German.
German?
Her entire family's German, yeah.
Close.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, yeah, that's. I think that's the biggest... biggest ethnic group in Minnesota for sure. I think also Wisconsin and perhaps Illinois.
There's a huge German, so Milwaukee on top, there's a lot of Germans there, and then Scandinavians more to the west side. Mm. So
her mother, we were talking earlier, I don't know if you want to bring this up, but beer is a big German thing.
Yes, we were talking about my name being a beer and my wife's grandmother calling me have a beer. and right up to, I think she was in her late 80s when she died. That would be the first thing she said when she would see me, so...
Well, it's a good mnemonic, I guess.
Yeah, totally. It's hard to forget.
So, do you like beer?
I like it less than I used to because I've learned the whole thing about carbs and calories and all of that.
Oh,
it takes
no.
takes away from the enjoyment. However,
see, that's the trouble. Too much knowledge.
Too much knowledge. It's terrible. So, but I do enjoy a glass every now and then.
Okay. Well, good. I don't want to ruin your marriage. So, and another question I have is... your company has been growing. Have you been adding employees over the years?
We have. We have probably close to 100 employees, between 90 and 100.
Wow.
And we do, you know, certain times of the year we have more employees and other times there's some temporary help that we get, especially during open enrollment where, you know, especially in our call center, we need support, maybe not on the advisor side, but on the back end, form processing and so on. So it's been growing.
Is it hard to find good employees?
I think it's always hard to find good employees, and especially in a startup, because what a good employee is often different. So just because you're very talented and competent doesn't necessarily mean you'll be very successful in a startup. So there are many people who are great in a structured environment, but are not as good when the environment becomes very ambiguous. So it is difficult to sort of get the group of people that you know are going to be really good for your startup. And the way we think about it, the way I think about it is, I don't want Gravy to be the best place to work, period. I want Gravy to be the best place to work for certain kinds of people. And those certain kinds of people aren't defined by, you know, race or age or education or whatever. It's almost a mindset of being able to be okay with ambiguity, being okay to take risks, be willing to fail and fess up to it when you do. So there are certain of these traits that we look for.
It sounds like you're defining an entrepreneur.
Yeah, it really is, because, you know, oftentimes the person who starts the company or is the CEO gets all the credit, much like the front man, you know, in a band. But all of the people that are taking the startup through its early days are all entrepreneurs, by the very definition of it, because they're taking, you know, outsized risks and taking on odds that any normal person would say, oh, those odds look a little bit, you know, tough. And yet, with full confidence and optimism, they charge on. So we are, I think you said it well, I think we are looking for entrepreneurs in addition to, you know, all the talents that you would need to be good at the job we're hiring for.
Hmm. I talked with one CEO of a financial services firm. They have the habit of hiring right out of college because they don't want their minds polluted by some other company.
Interesting.
And adopting habits that they might have to break.
Yeah.
How do you go about finding good people?
I think we do both. So I think there are jobs where, especially in a, you know, industry like healthcare, where you need domain knowledge. You're not going to be successful unless you know the material, and some of this stuff just comes with experience. And there are other jobs where that domain knowledge really isn't as useful, and what you need is you need the smarts, you need the intellectual horsepower, and just the, you know, the attitude of being able to, you know, the can-do attitude, if you will. So in those jobs, we often hire out from college, right out of college. You know, in many of our businesses or many of our roles, we have people that are very young and they don't have the experience that you would expect to find in that senior role. And then, of course, there are other roles where people have had 30 years of experience because they need it. And, you know, like compliance or some of those more technical insurance things are an example. You know, so you don't want someone who's never paid a claim to then head up paying claims, because that's probably not a great way to succeed. So we are, you know, we try to be as flexible as we can in our hiring. And our general mantra, if you will, is I personally am much more okay with having a false positive than having a false negative. So I'm okay with thinking somebody would be great and turns out that person really wasn't as good as I thought, versus somebody on paper doesn't look as good and then we never hired them and they could have been great if we had taken a chance on them. So we're always willing to take a chance on people, and even if it means that it doesn't work out.
It's gambling.
To some extent, and it's educated gambling, if you will, which, you know, I guess is...
Well, the more you do it, the better you get.
Yeah.
So are you short of employees, or do you always find somebody?
I think we're always in, you know, I wouldn't say short of employees overall, but there's always roles we're looking to fill. So I think there are a couple right now that we're looking to fill.
Okay. Well, I'm not looking right now, but I know where to look if I
yes.
Do. Talking with Abir Sen, and boy, I read somewhere you like cars.
I do.
Why is that, or how was that?
Well, that's probably a deep psychological question.
Okay.
But, no, I grew up, you know, in India, like having fascination with cars. We didn't really get, so we had, I think, two kinds of cars in India when I was growing up. So the idea of having
two brands of cars?
Two brands.
What were they?
One was called Ambassador, and one was called Fiat.
Fiat from Italy.
Yeah, except that it wasn't. It was usually actually a Morris 1100, but it was called Fiat for some strange reason, because I think there was a joint venture at one point. But, and there's not just two brands, there were two models. So there's just literally two cars that you can get.
So you can pick one or the other.
You can pick, yep, a black one of one or a white one of the other. So cars were a very common fascination. And of course, you know, that has carried through my youth. And you know, my co-founder and all my good friends are also, you know, they like cars, and they, you know, I think that interest has carried over.
Boy, do you ever work on cars?
I do to some extent. Unlike some people, I don't get, you know, so my interest, a lot of my sort of, you know, satisfaction isn't from tearing the engine apart and all of that. Sometimes it's just from looking at it, or, you know, driving it, or...
aesthetics.
Yeah, or going to a show where looking at other people's cars. So, you know, it's not necessarily collecting it either. So it's just overall interest. So.
Do you watch car races?
I do. When I can, you know, the Formula One is one I would really like to watch, but the timing oftentimes is so awkward that it's hard to watch it. And then you find, you know, on Yahoo News, you know the result, and therefore it takes away some of the...
Why is the timing hard?
Because the Formula One is just around the whole world. So it may be a race in Abu Dhabi, which is... 8 hours ahead.
Oh,
Australia.
It's a global deal.
It's a global deal. So.
Wow. But do you keep an eye globally on how healthcare systems work? Do you learn things from other countries?
You know, I think not too explicitly, but when I go to India, I mean, oftentimes, you know, with my parents' friends or other people in the industry, we'll start talking about healthcare. So I have a general understanding of how healthcare works, but I wouldn't say that I proactively keep tabs on what's happening globally on healthcare.
Mm. My daughter moved to Japan about a year ago, and she went to City Hall just to kind of register.
Yeah.
And they say, okay, here's your health insurance.
Oh, wow.
Bam.
Nice.
And, well, anyway, it's
different experience than here.
It's different experience there, and I get to feeling kind of jealous.
Yeah. I bet those antibiotics are covered there.
I bet they are. I would have been healthier sooner. I still have a bit of a cough, too. Maybe I can check that out. So do you travel much to other countries?
Yeah.
Besides India?
I enjoy traveling, so that's probably the top recreation thing for us to do. I'm a big Vikings fan, so I travel often to go to see Vikings games and other places. So,
wow.
So saw the Cowboys game recently. It was great in Dallas.
So you're a football fan?
I'm a big football fan, yes.
Wow. How did you get that from being in college?
That's a good point, because I'm a Vikings fan. I went to college in Wisconsin. I think my interest in football really happened right after I graduated college, because I was a big cricket nut in India, and there was no cricket here. So football got all my affections.
It filled the vacuum,
and the year was 1998, which was a good year to get into Vikings football. And despite many of those heartbreaks after that, it has stuck. And every year in September, I feel like this is the year. And this year in December, I still feel like this is the year, almost December.
Boy, heartbreak. What do they have in your health cabinet for Viking heartbreak?
Oh, my goodness. Nothing that's strong enough.
Nothing strong enough. Gosh. So you tell me, what else do you like to do? I mean, you got cars, you got football.
I love to cook. That's my probably main outlet on a day-to-day basis.
Really? So what do you like to cook?
So all kinds of, I would say, home Indian food, which is very different than the Indian restaurant Indian food.
Indian comfort food.
Yeah, which is a lot of, I mean, simple vegetables and, fishes and meats oftentimes, but lots of different vegetables. My wife's a vegetarian, so I cook a lot of vegetarian stuff. Lots of, like, lentils and pulses and that sort of stuff. But so I find cooking to be a real good de-stressor.
Because you're so focused on it.
It really is, because your mind is just focused on that one thing and making sure it turns out to be good. And
then you get the reward.
Yeah.
And then it's instant gratification.
Right. And then, it's just my wife and I, so then oftentimes then we are sending it all on to friends, and that's part of the fun as well.
So you get popular in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
It kind of brings me back. You mentioned you're a vegetarian.
My wife's a vegetarian.
Your wife's. Yeah. Oh, you're not.
I'm not. I like things that had mothers and fathers.
Did you grow up vegetarian?
I did not.
Okay.
Because
typically a lot of people from India are vegetarian.
The part of the country that I came from, it's pretty uncommon to be vegetarian.
Really?
Though there's not a lot of meat eating. It's mostly fish. So
you come here and marry a vegetarian.
Yeah, well, that's how things turn out.
Those Wisconsin, I mean, I think half the population of Wisconsin are cows.
Actually, that's probably true. But yeah, so that transition from Bombay to Wisconsin was actually a very pleasant one. So I went from a city of 16 million people to a city of 35,000 at the time.
Holy cow.
So it was
relaxing for you.
Relaxing. I loved it. I loved Lawrence, my undergrad. I'm a trustee now at Lawrence, still associated with the university. But it did, Lawrence was in this book that says colleges that change lives, and it actually did change my life. So.
Boy, is your picture in there?
I don't think so.
They better do a story on you. You're a trustee, man. You're a good story.
I'll translate that over to the marketing department.
Okay. Okay. We'll get that. Put that on the list there.
Yeah.
So was it at Lawrence you studied philosophy?
I did. Yeah.
What kind of philosophy?
So I had my favorite professor was an American pragmatist, a lot of John
Dewey. Oh, there you go.
He was a big John Dewey fan, but I went sort of off into the whole Schopenhauer, Kant.
Well, Schopenhauer, he studied Indian philosophy.
Of course, yeah. So he was quite influenced. And there was this book, which I believe is called World as Will and Representation, which, at the time, and I don't remember much of it now, but I remember being very struck by that. And that was my first introduction to that line of philosophy.
Well, Schopenhauer was big on well... Will he tied in with the whole idea of the importance of consciousness and awareness.
And exactly, the world being potentially what you want it to be, and how your will and the way you think about it actually changes what's happening out in the world.
And that's your entrepreneur foundation.
That might well have been. But,
we don't need a psychoanalyst. We just need a philosopher. And then pragmatism.
And the pragmatism is a really good tool on just day-to-day thinking. I think the whether you subscribe to their views or not, but the very idea of, you know, relativism versus absolutism and just understanding what those mean and how that could just, you know, affect people's behaviors, I think is instructive.
Well, I actually studied Indian philosophy in school.
Oh, did you?
And my professor out of Harvard, his whole thesis was that Indian philosophy is pragmatic.
Interesting.
Because they all shared the same goal of moksha, right?
Yeah.
Enlightenment.
Yep, moksha.
But there are different ways to get there.
Yeah.
So the means, you know, the end kind of whatever gets you there.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And, you know, what I find fascinating is I'm sort of an amateur student of physics, that a lot of things that are happening, advances in physics, is coinciding with a lot of that's been talked about by philosophers and even people in different religions. And that intersection is something that if I had all the time in the world and wasn't worried about healthcare, that I would love to go back to school and study that one more time. So
right, theoretical physics, because the more they get into either super small things
and
or
super
cosmic things
right,
their standard logic breaks down.
Correct.
So you got to start talking mystically.
That's exactly right.
Wow. Gosh, now I'm getting this aura, health and mysticism. Great. Well, thanks for joining us. We've been talking with Abir Sen, the CEO and co-founder of Gravy and co-founder of all these other things, Bloom Health, Definity Health, Red Brick. And who knows what's next?
Great. We'll see. I don't know myself, but
stay tuned.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Abir. You've been listening to Synapse Think Tank of the Air. I'm Steve LeBeau. I'd also like to thank Dan Culhane and to mention this is a co-production with WCCO Radio. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to Synapse Think Tank of the Air. I'm Leo Espinosa.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.